You're listening to Smart Talk. I'm Scott Lamar. Digital health or digital healthcare has accelerated during the coronavirus pandemic. Over the past 16 months, many of our doctor's appointments were conducted remotely, but that's just one aspect of it. Many providers and insurers are offering remote appointments for routine medical care. This innovative healthcare option is a game changer for many in that they open up access to a larger population of providers and specialists. Vaccine passports are an example of a digital health initiative that has been met with mixed reviews. New York State, for example, launched a passport app that tracks vaccine status and can be used to gain entry into restricted indoor spaces. Joining us today to talk about digital health is Michael Sievers. He's the program lead and assistant professor of healthcare informatics with Harrisburg University of Science and Technology. Dr. Sievers, welcome to the program.
Good morning. Thanks for having me. Glad to be here.
Is digital healthcare being used more often during the pandemic?
It has, but I think we have to first start for your listening audience to really define what digital health really is. It's actually a very broad term, and it's actually multidisciplinary. What do I mean by that? Besides the stakeholders of providers, hospitals, even insurance companies, we're also talking about the software and the hardware to move data between these particular stakeholders. So you can talk about mobile health, anything on your smartphone. You can talk about electronic medical and health record systems. Wearable devices have really increased recently to monitor blood pressure, heart rate, and things like that. And as you were saying, telemedicine. But just of interest, it also gets into virtual reality as well. And you're probably saying to yourself, virtual reality, how can that be for digital health? Well, in training, for instance, for doctors, for surgeries and things like that, you can use virtual reality. I know it almost sounds Star Trek-ish, but that is another aspect of it as well.
So I will ask that question again, though. Has the pandemic expanded digital health?
Well, in two major ways, as you were saying, telemedicine. Telemedicine has greatly increased. In fact, about a year ago, maybe 15 months ago, telemedicine increased dramatically because people didn't, A, want to go to the doctors, and B, that was their only option of going to the doctors. So it did increase. However, in the past, maybe 6 months to 8 months, it has decreased somewhat. But people are now more receptive of doing telemedicine than they did prior to the pandemic. A lot of the younger generation was okay with telemedicine prior to the pandemic, but it seems like older folks, and I can include myself in that, have been receptive to telemedicine. So it has greatly increased. And with wearable devices, the data from the wearable devices can go directly to the doctor's office to give the information, for instance, with the blood pressure and heart rates and things like that. Another thing with telemedicine we've found is behavioral health has really had an uptick in telemedicine because people are more able to just be in their own house and receptive of mental health type applications from a telehealth perspective.
I want to talk about all those things that you just mentioned, Dr. Sievers, but let's focus on telemedicine for just a moment. You said that we've seen a decrease in usage over the last 6 months or so. Why?
People are going back to on-ground medical situations because not everything can be done in regards to telemedicine. Very easy items, like I said, behavioral health type things, those things, but people still wanted to go back to the doctor's office. Now, when I say a decrease, I'm not saying substantial, that it essentially went down to, you know, 1-2%, but people are feeling more comfortable about going back into the office of the doctors. But the one thing that we do have to talk about with telemedicine, and I know it's brought up quite a bit, is actually that digital divide situation. Not everybody still has that capability of doing it. And right before the talk here, I looked up some of the Pew research that has been done, and essentially 27% of our rural population still has slow speeds in relationship to telemedicine. So they can't really connect very well. 21 million people in the United States still don't have internet connections. And it's really hurting the people with incomes less than $30,000 a year. For instance, 24% don't have smartphones, and that's only down 1% in the last 2 years. So the digital divide is really an issue that we have to tackle here in the United States.
You know, what's kind of ironic about that is that when we first started talking, we, meaning as a society, as the medical community started talking about telemedicine, one of the advantages was described as being able to reach rural patients, patients in rural areas that had to travel miles to be able to get to their doctor or to a hospital. And just what you described, I mean, we have found this to be a real issue during the pandemic because of the number of school students that have been in class remotely. That, you know, the irony is that telemedicine would, you know, ideally we would have access to a lot of people in rural areas, but a lot of those same people don't have access to the internet or Wi-Fi.
And you're absolutely right. You're bringing up a point. It's kind of like a catch-22. And I don't care what side of the political fence you're on, but some people may remember Rural Electric. And it was a push to get electricity out to all the people in rural America. And from a government policy perspective, is that something that we now need to do for internet, be it like a rural internet push instead of rural electricity? The post office goes to everybody in the United States. We try to get electricity to everybody that wants it in the United States. Are we to the point? It's a question for our society. Should we push that into internet capability?
Okay, here's one of the questions that I personally have had, and I've talked to other people who have had the same question. I've had a number of remote appointments with my family doctor during the pandemic, actually even before. But I always have this question in my mind, when should I do this remotely and when should I go to the doctor's office in person? How do you make that decision?
Well, and it's not just the patient's decision. The doctor should be helping out with that decision as well. In talking to various doctors, the answer that I've gotten is, does it need a point of touch in some way? Or can it be a visual situation? If it's visual, even for, you know, skin rashes and things like that, you don't have to go to the doctor. But if the doctor somehow has to touch you in a certain way, obviously surgery or something like that, that is really the point that you need to see a doctor on ground. Does that make sense?
Yeah, but I can see the day where we will be doing surgery remotely. So, you know, maybe in your own home. But that probably is down the road a little bit. But, you know, something you just said, I thought that would be part of your answer, is that the doctor would have to make a big decision with that. But, you know, I think about it on a personal basis that when you're in the doctor's office and maybe you go for a specific reason, but while you're there, he asks anything else that we should talk about. And sometimes it ends up with him looking at something else. I'm wondering if that can be done through telemedicine, those kind of conversations. I mean, I'm sure that the doctor can ask, is there anything else you're concerned about? But still, does it have that same feel as being in the doctor's office?
It doesn't yet. And asking about that, the other situations, it's going to be a touchy situation in that sometimes it's all about time. And what do I mean by that? That a telemedicine visit on the doctor's end, you know, might be a certain amount of time. Just like a dentist visit when you get your teeth cleaned, it might only be 15 minutes, and that's really all the time that they've allotted. So it's going to be a challenge as we still wrestle with telemedicine going out of the pandemic on the time boxing and things like that. Because with healthcare, I hate to say it, it's all about the money. So we have to be careful in that.
Speaking of which, there has been some pushback from insurance companies paying the same rate or paying for the same doctor's visit remotely compared to an in-person visit. Have those issues been resolved?
They haven't been resolved in all states, and you bring up a very good point. These things in states are called parity laws, and what parity means is that an office visit will be paid at the same rate as a telemedicine visit. Now, there's two sides of the fence on this one. The insurance companies, as you were bringing up, the argument there is, well, you're not paying for the real estate or the renting and the electricity and all those particular things. So, and whatever needs to be put into the doctor's office, medications, whatever, isn't being paid for. So it should be at a lesser rate. The providers in the hospitals, they actually say, well, that is true. However, now we need IT resources. We need better network connections. We need better servers and things like that. And we may even have to hire IT staff. So they're arguing that while the costs are less when it comes to rent and things like that, the costs have increased on the other side. So most of the time now, those two things, telemedicine visits and on-ground visits, are paid the same. And CMS, Medicare, they've backed that up, especially here in the pandemic timeframe. So it's going to be interesting to see once we get out of the pandemic if that stays in place. But a lot of states do have parity laws that say they need to be paid at the same rate.
You know, Dr. Severs, I may have asked you this before, but this is, you have a title that maybe a lot of people aren't familiar with. Informatics. What is informatics?
Very good question. Informatics, think of it this way from a healthcare perspective. Prior to electronic health record systems, for instance, in the hospital to collect data on the patient while in the hospital or the providers, I don't know if a lot of people remember, but there were manila folders of documents that were in the hospital, and basically those were the records of the patients. Now, because it's electronic, wow, we actually have data to actually crunch and do research on artificial intelligence, big data, et cetera. So informatics is essentially the analysis of that data and the presentation of that data, well, let's say to senior management in the hospital, to say what's going on, if there's an outlier that suddenly becomes a regular population like the pandemic with COVID. That's what informatics is all about, essentially really doing analysis with the data that we finally have in healthcare. Other industries have had data for a long time, the banking industry, manufacturing, et cetera, but it wasn't really until the electronic health record systems in hospitals that we finally are able to really do the research that's needed in today's society.
So at the bottom of the bed in the hospital now is an iPad rather than that folder.
Yes, exactly. But in healthcare, we're not quite there yet completely, because you probably go into your dentist office and still maybe see some manila folders around. So the healthcare system hasn't embraced it completely, but we're getting there.
Okay. You had touched on this a little bit earlier about data sharing, about some of these wearable devices. What kind of devices are there available now that your doctor can access the information that is on that device?
Well, I can give you an example. The Cleveland Clinic has actually put Bluetooth in the pacemakers that are going in. So on a patient's app on their phone, they get the data from the pacemaker, and that app can then send it into the Cleveland Clinic to do the monitoring real time on the patient that's out there. Other wearable devices are just, you know, the iWatch and things like that to give you the blood rates. There are people that have embedded with the patches that can get the blood sugar and glucose levels and real time feed that back to the doctor. And you were saying about informatics. Well, informatics then can look real time to see, okay, if the blood sugar rates go way up, a red flag can be immediately notified to the doctor for that particular patient who's, you know, who knows, they might be in Walt Disney World and can then, from a telemedicine perspective, get in touch with them immediately to say you need some help.
So going back to your first example of Bluetooth with pacemakers, is that just to communicate with the healthcare provider, or does that actually is it actually involved with the operation of the pacemaker?
We're getting there. From the research and reading that I've done, we're not quite there. It's being experimented on, but we'll get there.
Because I, again, maybe it's my age or whatever, but I didn't trust the Bluetooth to operate my pacemaker. I don't have one, but I'm just saying, I'm using that as an example, you know. But you're yeah. saying that that is in the future.
Yeah, right now it's data collection. Mm-hmm. It's not really gearing towards that.
Okay. So federal blocking rules. This was something that I have to say that I was unfamiliar with. What are federal blocking rules? What does it refer to?
You're not the only one. And in fact, the healthcare industry is still struggling with this one. And for the listening audience, I really do not like the term blocking rules, because these rules are to not block data. And when I say not block, meaning not block patient data. If a patient wants their data from a hospital, a provider, even like a health insurance company, these rules are saying those particular entities can't block you from getting the electronic data anymore. In fact, it used to be that they even charged for the data, sometimes like $10 and $25 for some of the electronic data. Now it's even harder to even put a fee or a surcharge on that. So what are these blocking rules really for? It's the ability for the patient to accumulate all the medical data that is needed for them to understand. So if you go to a hospital here in Pennsylvania and you're a snowbird, and you go to a hospital in Florida, you'd be able on your app, on your iPhone, to get this data, the hospital notes, the doctor notes, all that information, the medical pharmacy information. So those entities in healthcare can't block you from getting that data. And right now, it's really focused on the IT and developers to make sure that you have APIs. And APIs are application programming interfaces to go in and get that data. And I think the fees or the penalties are up to $1 million for anything that is brought up for a blocking situation. However, right now, doctors and hospitals, they haven't released what the penalty is for that yet. But hopefully that explains it a little bit. You can't block patients or other entities from getting the data that's being requested from a healthcare organization.
Why would a provider block a patient anyway? I mean, doesn't the patient have a right to, I mean, when we look at the old-fashioned manila folder, don't they have a right to their own medical records?
Yeah, and even HIPAA started with this, that, you know, HIPAA, you were supposed to be able to get your own data. It's all about, it's like technology. Healthcare organizations haven't focused and put monies into doing this electronically. And these blocking rules are the push from the government to get that to happen. I don't care what side of the political fence you're on for government regulations, but the healthcare industry seems to have needed to be pushed with HIPAA, with high tech, to get electronic health record systems, and this, the CARES Act, to push healthcare organizations to do the electronic software and hardware needed to do this.
So it sounds like it's a money issue.
It has been in the healthcare. Yeah, I said it before. Unfortunately, it all boils down to the money. It's all about the money.
So HIPAA, as you mentioned, still applies here. Are there others who would be able to access your medical records?
If you give them the ability to do that, you still have control. So if you wanted, let's say you download the Apple app for it, or the Google app or something like that, that's being stored from a Google perspective. Some people are saying, well, does Google have access to your data? No, not necessarily, but we do have to put HIPAA privacy rules in place for that not to happen. But it's only if you give the ability for another third-party entity to access the data. So you still have approval rights.
How long is that data stored?
Good question. And that's with the blocking rules, that really hasn't been defined. At least I haven't been able to find it. The one thing with blocking rules is some people thought that, well, first of all, it went into effect April 5th of this year, okay? And some people thought that any data created after April 5th fell into blocking rules. That's not true. You can get your electronic information prior to April 5th. But how long? That hasn't absolutely been defined. So good question. I unfortunately don't have the answer for that one.
Well, see, as I was asking the question, I was thinking to myself, because this is relatively new, meaning the last decade or so, do we even have enough time to know how long some of these records will be stored?
Yeah, and the other question is, does the hospitals and providers actually have to take those paper and like scan them in to make them PDFs or something like that, so they are available electronically? So the blocking rules haven't completely defined all that yet.
We talked earlier, Dr. Sievers, about some of the challenges that are out there. Access, obviously, being one of the big ones. But are there other challenges when it comes to digital health?
Well, I didn't, because of time, I didn't know if you wanted to get into vaccine passports.
Yes, let's do that.
That is a major issue right now. And the one question that I've been asked, quite a few people have asked me, is, doesn't HIPAA deal with vaccine passports and you can't do anything because of HIPAA? And I want the listening audience to understand that HIPAA applies to the medical profession. It's medical focus, for instance, on providers, hospitals, insurance companies, any subcontractors, et cetera, that they cannot provide that data. They have to keep it secure, things like that. HIPAA does not apply to regular retail, grocery stores, concert promoters, or anything like that. HIPAA is specific to the healthcare industry. So the answer is no. And the second thing is, if you're giving the information from your vaccine passport over to, let's say, a concert person, you're willingly giving that over. So HIPAA is about not willingly giving your healthcare data over. So that's the first thing to get out of the way, that it's not HIPAA related. But with vaccine passports, it's an absolute challenge, because what is a vaccine passport? The United States seems to be defining it as, okay, binary. Did you get the vaccine or not? However, the European Union is defining it a little bit broader. Not only the vaccine itself, but have you had a COVID test in the last 2 weeks that was negative? Did you have COVID? And what was the date of your COVID? And why they're doing that is they think that you have the antibodies to deal with it. So different countries are different, looking at the definition of a vaccine passport differently. So it's one challenge. And the other challenge is this. People are equating it to your driver's license. Like if you go into a bar, you have to be 21. Well, there's some challenges to that comparison because everybody knows what the date is to compare it to make sure that you're 21. But with vaccine passports, we already have three different vaccines in the United States. With those vaccines, it's not 100% accurate. It's like at a 95% level. Now, when we get into booster shots, where does the boundary exist there if you're vaccinated or the dates of your booster shots and things like that? And now you're putting the whole onus on the host and hostess at a restaurant to define what that is and certify that a particular vaccine is valid or not. And then finally, right now, the vaccine type things are paper. Anybody can fraudulently create one of these. In fact, in the last week or two, probably a lot of your listening audience has seen that people are being arrested now because of the fraudulent vaccine CDC cards that are being created.
Yeah, I even saw a story this morning that even some healthcare workers who didn't want to get vaccinated have purchased some fraudulent I don't know whether you call it vaccine passports or the CDC card. But New York is a state that it was one of the first to implement vaccine passports. What's been their experience? Is it what you just described, some of the unknowns?
It is. And you were saying about what New York has done. That's the other challenge with the United States. We're going to have so many different software companies coming out with their own vaccine passport. I know California, I was talking to a couple doctors 2 weeks ago from California. They're doing their own thing out in California. New York's doing their own thing. With the TSA and security, there's a that Clear app on your phone. They're trying to get into the vaccine passport. So it's going to be tough, again, going back to a host and hostess, knowing all the different apps that possibly can show that a vaccine is valid or not. So it's a challenge.
You were talking about the European Union. European Union just this week talked about Americans coming in having to prove they've been vaccinated or, as you said, that they've had a recent negative test. So there are Americans that, even if in their own states, aren't impacted by it. If they decide to travel to Europe, for example, they may be. Dr. Severs, we only have a few minutes left. One thing I did want to ask you about, and this is completely off the subject of vaccine passports, for example, but Pennsylvania recently had to reduce the numbers of how many people were vaccinated, their publicly announced numbers, because there wasn't a way, they said that there wasn't a way to track people who got their first and second shots at two different places. Now, when I first saw that, this came out like last Friday. It hasn't gotten a lot of attention. That would seem to be something that would be obvious to keep track of digitally, wouldn't it?
It would be in other industries, but I resurrect again from earlier that the healthcare system, unfortunately, here in the United States, we have great research. We have great doctors, nurses, and things like that. But IT, and I'm an IT person, so I can bust on myself. IT has been slow compared to other industries. So something as simple as connecting two different records with the same patient should be relatively straightforward. We just haven't had the ability, and it's unfortunate that the pandemic situations like this, it will be looked at, it will be addressed and rectified in the future. But the healthcare industry has always been behind when it comes to computers, software, and hardware.
You know, and I've been thinking this throughout our conversation, that when we're talking about the pandemic, I mean, this is still a new virus. Even though we've been in this situation, it seems like a long time. It's been 18 months at the most, and we're learning as we go. With that said, you know, when we were talking about fraudulent cards that were proof of vaccination and all that, you know, think about it. We're looking at a card that the CDC produced that for the most part is handwritten or had a sticker placed on it. So it's very simple. Not even something that, you know, has a cover on it, or, and that's one of the reasons it can be, you know, that so many people can make up their own. I mean, that to me just kind of shows that, first of all, that we have learned a lot, that a lot have changed over the past 16 to 18 months. But at the same time, just what you're describing, that from the very early on, we didn't do this digitally, that we did it. We counted on doctors and nurses to write in whether the date, whether you've been vaccinated and the date. I mean, it just seems kind of 20th century-ish, if that's a word.
And no, you're right. And the CDC, I mean, you're probably saying to yourself, well, why did they do this? Well, going back to paper is the easiest, especially when you look at the digital divide and being equitable across the board. Everybody can have this particular card. Unfortunately, there's no picture on it to verify who you are. You can scan it in for electronic, but paper was the easiest and quickest way at that point in time.
Dr. Michael Sievers is the program lead and assistant professor of healthcare informatics with Harrisburg University of Science and Technology. Dr. Sievers, thank you very much for being with us today.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me. Appreciate it.